With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
United Airlines Flight 811 was a regularly scheduled airline flight from LA through to Sydney with intermediate stops Honolulu and Auckland. On the 24th of February, 1989, the Boeing 747-122 serving the flight experienced a cargo door failure in flight shortly after leaving Honolulu. The resulting explosive decompression blew out several rows of seats, killing nine passengers. The aircraft returned to Honolulu and landed without further incident. Starting in Honolulu, Flight 811 was under the command of Captain David M. or Dave Cronin. He was 59 years old at the time. At the time of the accident, Cronin had logged around 28,000 flight hours, including 1,600 hours in Boeing 747 aircraft. Flight 811 was Cronin's penultimate scheduled flight before his mandatory retirement. The remaining flight crew consisted of First Officer Gregory Allen Al Slater, who was 48, and flight engineer Randall Mark Thomas, 46, and 15 flight attendants. The first officer and flight engineer had logged 14,500 flight hours and 20,000 flight hours, respectively. On board, 355 occupants, 337 passengers, 18 crew, and there were 9 fatalities, 38 injuries, and 346 survivors. About a week ago, this Facebook comment was posted by Beverly to the post of me referencing the David Cronin analogy, and this is what it said. From Beverly Thomas: I was a passenger on Flight 811. David Cronin, a born-again Christian, knew what guided him safely back that night. I met and had the pleasure of staying with him. It's now 35 years since that air disaster, but I remember every second to this day. Beverly Thomas. Now, I think she made that post on our social media because she was made aware of part of a speech I made about a year ago where I used Captain David Cronin's example as an analogy, and comments he made in a documentary about Flight 811, which I viewed more than a decade ago. And his words, and I couldn't remember them exactly, but certainly the gist of them have always stuck in my head. And I've actually, they've been motivational when times have been tough. And I used this analogy in this way. I said that in this interview with David Cronin, he made a comment that all his 28,000 flight hours had gone into being able to deal with this one particular event, which was on the penultimate flight of his career. And I thought about that a lot. And in times in my career where things were getting boring or didn't seem to be going anywhere, or the part of work I was doing was just not doing it for me, I thought of those comments. Everything you do, you know, kind of adds up to something. And then when RCR came along and a whole lot of things came into focus, I understood what he said even more. So I used it as an analogy, just a quick comment as part of a speech that I was giving. And recently that's been posted, that bit of it. I could have done my hair better. But that's been posted on our social media as part of the comeback of RCR. And that has been the connection that we have with Beverly. And she contacted us. And of course, curiosity and fascination and all those things immediately came into play for me. And I was so happy to hear that Beverly was willing to come on RCR and tell that story. Beverly, I know it's a bit of a long-winded way to get started, but we had to set the table, as they say. Welcome to RCR. Thank you so much for making that posted comment on our social media. I've been so looking forward to chatting with you about this. Thank you.
Thank you. Referring to Dave being coming a born-again Christian, I've actually got a document which I can send you in the post that I'm sure you'd love to read.
I would.
And it's to do with the flight. I've also actually got a tape recording with him telling his testimonium. And I have no longer got a tape recorder to record it, but I have heard it, and it's Dave himself telling his but he was invited back to New Zealand for a special award, and the Campbells, who I had met at, by that stage, invited me down, and that's where I first met him. I had written a letter to him when I got home. I didn't think it would ever reach him, but it did, and he personally wrote to me and anyone else who wrote, thanking us for our letters, and that was amazing. I just couldn't believe I was actually getting a letter from Dave Cronin.
Yeah. Let's go through what happened. So it was the 24th of February, 1989. The flight was, a regular scheduled United Airlines flight, 747, from Los Angeles to Sydney, intermediate stops, Honolulu and Auckland, as it was back in the day. How did you come to be on that 747?
Well, I explained in my letter that I had three stopovers, and I did the first one in New York, and the second one I did in LA for two or three days, and then my third one was Hawaii, and that's how I happened to be in Hawaii. But I almost missed that flight because I forgot about the international dateline, and my travel agent had said, I'm going to book you into the hotel for a third night because you don't fly out till 1:30 in the morning, and they'll make you leave at 10 o'clock with your luggage, and you've got all those hours to fill in. So we'll book you in the hotel for another night. Now, so much had happened in my life with these other disasters, I completely forgot about that. Got my tickets out to look. It was Thursday, and I see that I'm landing on Saturday, and then the penny dropped, the international dateline.
Yeah.
So I managed.
You're not the first, Beverly. You're not the first to be hit with
well,
that one.
I threw everything into my bags and down the lift, and shuttles were going by every half hour or so. So I actually got to the airport in time and was sitting waiting when the plane came in, and people got off. Some went to get, they were staying, so they went to baggage claim, and those that were continuing on came and sat in the departure lounge, and that's where I met up with Lee Campbell.
Yeah, we'll talk about Lee a bit later on because yes, that's a very important part of the story as well. So as far as everyone was concerned, apart from the being a bit hassled and hustled, this was just a regular flight. It's happened thousands of times across the Pacific in one of the safest aircraft in the world. Did you have any nervousness around flying, Beverly?
Yes. I just knew that I had to get back down to the Southern Hemisphere. So certainly I was very nervous. And some of us had wandered over to look at the plane, and we thought it looked very old. It looked as though it needed a bit of a paint. And one or two commented and said, oh, that looks an old plane.
Yeah.
And those were sort of memories that came back later, how we'd thought it was an old plane.
Well, at that, excuse me, at that stage it would have been about,
19.
Was it 19 years old at that point? Was it? Okay. So, yeah, it was getting on in age, presumably mechanically sound, though that turned out to be something. So, and tell me if I'm getting too far ahead of myself. You sat next to, and we'll get the story on that shortly, Lee Campbell of Wellington. That will be significant soon. So you get on the flight like you normally do.
Yes.
Where were you sitting? What was your allocated seat?
Now, I was sitting at the beginning of economy, and it was unusual seating because at the window side, the first three seats were just a pair of seats.
Yep.
And then the third one, they started to be three. And I was on the seat of the third one where I had nothing in front of me. I felt as though I was sitting in the middle of the aisle.
Right, gotcha.
But can you understand? Behind me,
yep,
it was three.
You can visualize
three.
It.
Yep. Okay. And so that's why I had a clear view. They were busy. They were going to get us our meal quickly because it was 1:30 in the morning. And so the drinks cabinet, if you look in that picture, you'll see the end of it in the exit entrance. There was an exit entrance between us and business class.
Yep.
Well, normally they pull a little curtain to keep us peasants in our area and the business class. But they didn't pull that curtain. The stewardesses seemed to be working at the beginning of ours and the end of business. And they were preparing the trolley to take round for drinks. And our dinner menus had been given out. And that's really when it all happened.
Right. So you'd taken off, you're in the sky, about 20 minutes into the flight, was it, or less
than
that?
It was 20 minutes in.
Yep.
We were still climbing. We were only at 22,000 feet, and we were still in that position of climbing when there was this almighty hissing sound.
Yeah. Was there a bang, or was it just hissing?
Yeah, it followed. A big, big, long hissing sound followed by a thump. I always describe it as a pop gun with a cork on the end. When you pull it, that was sort of, it was a thump.
Yep.
And, of course, the plane started to sway. And we were in stunned silence. Nobody was screaming. We were, I think the horror, it was a nightmare that we hoped we really weren't in.
And confronted with that just instantaneously, 355 occupants on the plane, 337 passengers, 18, obviously, crew. What happened in the immediate aftermath? You've got papers and everything flying around, I would imagine. Pressurized air in the cabin is flying out that, and I think David Cronin's word was humongous hole. So tell us what that scene was like.
Well, what initially happened was that the cabin filled up with a fog-like material, and you couldn't sort of see, and then that gradually cleared. The staff, the stewardesses, they jumped into action and were doing what they'd been trained to do. They were absolutely wonderful. They managed to have a megaphone, a hand megaphone. And I know as I was on the aisle, I said, "Where are the oxygen masks?" And they said, "We don't need them," because what we didn't know was that David dropped the plane down as quick as he could so that, that we wouldn't need them. But, of course, the whole mechanism of the oxygen masks were ripped out with the plane.
Okay. There was no way the oxygen masks were ever going to come down.
No.
Yeah.
They were never going to come down. And all the above lockers were bursting open and their contents were flying around. And I could see my camera didn't pick up the hole. I could see the lady's hair straight up in the air, her long hair.
Yeah.
And, of course, glasses were flying around, and the decompression, the noise was horrendous. You couldn't talk to the person next to you. The noise was so loud. But when that fog cleared, a young guy in one of the pairs, the first pair of seats, I looked up and he had his camera on the top of the seat taking photos. And I'm thinking, oh, gosh, what's he doing that for? And then I thought, oh, my bag with my little instant camera was between my knees. I'll take a couple of photos. They might find my camera floating in the sea. Yeah.
That's happened before as well. So, yeah, you're right to consider that.
So I took that photo to the front, and the other one didn't seem to want to go, but I took the people who were in the middle section in the brace position. Oh, of course, we've got our life jackets on, naturally. That was the first thing we were all...
Because you're over the ocean, right? At that point,
yes, but it was dark. Remember, we left at 1:30, so we didn't know really where we were.
So that is always going to get your attention. Something like that happening it was unprecedented, actually. It had happened before, but the aircraft had not survived. So the fact that it survived, it made it unprecedented. So you've got this huge hole that's dawning on people, that there's this huge hole in the forward fuselage under the upper deck. Now, that resulted, didn't it? And this is where we'll get to the Campbells a bit later in this chat as well. Somehow, the forward cargo door, which is a big door, activated itself, and the door opened and got caught in the, about 350-mile-an-hour slipstream, and got peeled off and peeled the cabin wall off. Is that how it happened?
Yes, and it ripped the side of the aeroplane and also the cargo area at the bottom. You would have seen photos, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, I have. They're famous. Yeah. Yeah. It's like Dave Cronin said, humongous. He didn't find out about what it had hit them until a bit later on from that. But, okay, then it becomes clear that some seats are missing, right?
Well, not to me it didn't, because but to the people sitting in business, sitting in that middle section, they could see the sky, and they realised that the people had gone out. And, I mean, there was one person, I think it was row 13, and she was sitting with her feet over the precipice waiting to be the next one sucked out. Wow. Because the seats were still screwed, you know, they went out, seats and all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some, I mean, it's grisly, but it's reality. It's what happened. Some went through the inboard engine or...
One woman.
Okay, so that's horrific. Then up the front, you've got the crew in the cabin dealing with it. Up the front in the flight deck of the 747, you've probably got one of the most experienced crews you could ever want. Am I correct?
Well, it turned out that way, didn't it?
Yeah.
You mentioned about him retiring. The retiring age was 60.
Oh, it was 60 then. Okay.
And yes, and they looked into it after that, because why should they retire a person with so much experience at 60? I think they've now raised the American retirement age to 65.
But yeah, they have. 60. Yeah, I realized
that. It was 60.
That.
Yeah.
Okay, so now they've got an epic battle on their hands to try and fly the stricken aircraft back to Honolulu with only one opportunity to land it. They've got an engine down, they've got damage to their control surfaces, etc. They're overweight because he had all the fuel, right, to get to Auckland.
Yes, and so he was busy ditching that, as it turned out.
Yeah. And through incredible management, I mean, all the crew were involved in that, but led by him, he was able to eke out, I think they describe it in aviation as manage the energy on the plane to come back for, and again, in his interview that I watched, he described it as one of the best landings of his life.
And it was. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, the air brakes on the wings that really shudder, you know, that shudder. Yep. They weren't there. So there was no shuddering. So suddenly we didn't even know we'd hit the ground.
Okay, they call it a butter landing in the business. Sounds like that's what it was. And was able to stop on the runway in time not to run off the end, which is another danger. Is there anything more to tell us about the period of time after you kind of, the mist is clearing from the decompression and you're sort of getting a gauge of what might have happened here through to that landing? Is there anything else that happened that was significant there? I mean, emotions must have been running so high, the fear, the horror.
Well, I remembered I just revalidated my first aid certificate, and they talked about what is it when you land in the sea? The word's gone out of my head. When you freeze to death. So I grabbed a jersey that was in the bag at my feet and put it on. So if I landed in the sea, you know, I had some warmth.
Well, you're always thinking, that's good.
If we'd landed in the sea, I wouldn't be talking to you now.
No,
I realise that.
Dave said
if we'd been at our full height, it would have been like Lockie B. It would have just been like a tin opener and the fuselage would have been separated from the cockpit if we'd been at our full height.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be sitting here. But what did happen was I was busy blowing up a little neck cushion to have around my neck, and the decompression, I suddenly looked down and it's about four times as big as what it should be.
Yeah.
And it flew out of my hand like a balloon and disappeared, okay?
Yeah.
Well, you can believe this or not, but that neck cushion arrived in an envelope to me.
What?
Yeah, saying it was found floating in the sea. Now, everybody laughs, but being a teacher, I named everything, and I had my name and address on a flap on the side of it. Now, how's that for a story?
Man. I think I'm feeling that there are going to be quite a few sort of intersection points along the way that, I don't know, they mean something or they don't, but they're just so fascinating. So
I just think you need to come up and visit me. I've got so much to tell.
Well, I'm starting to think so as well. Okay, so you've landed. What state of the passengers? A lot of passengers there. I guess further down the back, it's not so intense, though. It's still noisy as hell, yeah. And there's obviously something wrong. Captain Cronin is managing the power and trying to eke out every last foot of altitude.
Well, he, of course, didn't know initially until he sent Al Slater or one of them down to have a look, who came up very white-faced and said, "Sir, there's a big hole in the side of the plane." So then, of course, we all thought bomb. See, it wasn't long after Lockerbie. And
Oh, wait on, there's a connection you have with Lockerbie in a sort of
that's what I'm saying.
Interesting way. Maybe it's a good time to tell us about that quickly.
Well, United Airlines became Pan Am, as you do as you go along, and I get into Heathrow to meet up with my daughter, and we get out to the taxi, and he says, "Have you just come in on that Pan Am flight from New York?" And I said, yes. He said, "Well, the one that left about half an hour ago has just been blown up over Lockerbie."
Lockerbie. Gee.
And, of course, as I said in my thing, the first message that my family heard, they didn't say what way it was going.
Yep.
And, of course, they knew I was in New York. So
I've got a similar thing because I was traveling to the UK right at that time as well, and I flew from New York to London on TWA on a 747. And on the day after I left to go back to New York and come back through the States eventually to New Zealand on TWA on the 747 again, Lockerbie happened. A lot of my friends knew I was away and thought I might have been on that. So that was a thing. But here's the thing. The aircraft I flew back on was the one that blew up off the coast of New York when I think Bill Clinton was president.
Yeah.
So I can relate to that. You also... There was an involvement with another aircraft that you flew on that crashed a short time later. Tell us quickly about that too.
Well, that I think you've discovered it was a British Midlands, was it? Or it was one of And we had travelled. It was a very new plane, and we must have gone over on Christmas Eve, I think, because I remember having a fancy dinner and a little bottle of champagne. And when we were over staying with our relatives,
that's in Ireland, right? Ireland.
This is in Ireland, Belfast. Yep. Northern Ireland, and. This jolly plane crashed. I'm pretty sure it was the M4.
Kegworth was the location. It's actually the M1. I was just having a look at it before.
Was it the M1?
Yeah, but it was just missed the motorway and hit the bank before it.
And I think that was later established as pilot error.
Yeah, they shut the wrong engine down.
Yeah.
Well,
the thing was, as you can imagine, with Lockerbie and that, the newspapers, the news media, it was just every day full of pictures, and of course, most of the ones killed in that were Irish people. So, and I was over in Ireland, and I remember going to church and the minister saying, "Christmas Day will not be cancelled." He kept saying, "Christmas Day will not be cancelled because of this terrible thing." Oh, it was awful.
Yeah, it was. It was a terrible thing.
So when I got back to London, I tried to get a refund from Pan Am and come home on Air New Zealand. But they wouldn't give me a refund. I couldn't afford another fare. So I was faced with having to get on Pan Am, who assured me they were the safest airline in the world after that. And so it was half empty when I went to LA on it.
Yeah, I can imagine why. Okay, so little did you know.
And I was starting to relax because it had been a good flight, and the flight to Hawaii was on United Airlines again. And so I was beginning to feel a bit more relaxed inside me.
Now, the time between this all happening and landing, how were the passengers? Was there any panic or were people calm? It must have
been. There was only one lady who screamed. She was up in business class, and apparently Dave was telling you she was an air hostess on holiday, and her partner had gone to the toilet when it all happened, and she thought he'd gone out through the hole.
Oh, right.
When he was missing, and she got hysterical. She got hysterical. Somebody from behind where I was sitting ran up and picked her up bodily, took her back, and strapped her into a spare seat. But Dave later told me that she actually collapsed. She went silent while she collapsed.
Oh, okay.
At that stage. No, everybody remember we were told to be in the brace position. Everybody had their the stewards had checked that everybody had their vests on, their life vests. So they all had their heads down against the back of the seat in front. Though I couldn't because I had no seat in front of me. But when you have no seat, you just put your head down.
And you hold your ankles or something, don't you?
I can't remember what I did. Well, all I can.
Was David Cronin or any of his crew, I guess so much noise around, were they able to say anything or make any announcements?
No, you couldn't hear. That's why the staff were using handheld megaphone things.
Okay.
But as soon as we landed, we were ordered to get up. Well, of course, the chutes were on the other side from where I was sitting.
Yeah.
And when you stand looking at that, you're about two stories high.
Yeah, it's a long way up. It is.
A long way down.
Well, down. If you're looking up, or down.
And if you didn't jump, you were helped. You were pushed.
They wanted you out of there.
They evacuated 300 and whatever we were, in 47 seconds. So we were moving. Well, that's where I sustained an injury at that stage.
Oh, what happened to you?
Well, the person behind me crashed into me with their shoes on.
Okay. You're not supposed to have the shoes on, are you?
No, but who's going to think of that in that sort of a crisis?
No one was carrying their carry-on baggage, I hope.
Well, I just had a little kit thing with my camera in it.
Right.
Now, I had just taken those two photos, and I still had the camera in one hand and the cover of it in the other. Mm-hmm. And when I landed, I just handed my camera to someone and I said, take. And they took that awful photo.
Okay.
Yeah. That's how it happened. And then they gave me back the camera. I took some pictures, which I've got here, of people standing. Most of them sort of took their life jackets off straight away and were just holding them and that.
Did anyone get an opportunity to walk around and
no. I was on the same side as the hole. Now, another couple from Hastings here, they were in the very back seat of the third compartment back, right on the tail, and they thought a window had popped out. That's what it sounded like to them.
Right, yeah.
When their exit door was open, their chute to jump down was hanging by one corner, so they couldn't go down it. So I'm pretty sure they had to open the exit door on the same side as the hole. So whether those people, when they landed, saw the hole, I don't know.
Okay, so the relief must have been huge that you'd made it back and you'd landed and you're off the aircraft and that you'd survived. Well, what's that feeling like?
Look, I just was so sure that my end had come that, you know, I was trembling. Well, I was trembling with shock as it happened. I suddenly started to shake before I jumped down the chute, and I thought, this is delayed shock.
Right, yeah, shock reaction, yeah.
Yes, well, as I said, I just revalidated my first aid and was up to date with what happens to you. And but the thing was that we were in the middle of the airfield, a long way from the actual airport, which had closed down when our plane went out. There was no one in the airport. It was shut. And they had prior warning, obviously, and by the time they transported us in little funny little bus things back to the airport, but there was nothing, no emergencies, no cups of coffee, no, you know.
Yeah,
and, no, and one we there. Were, no, no one there. Those who smoked and had managed to grab their cigarettes, they all got in one corner, puffing away.
I bet they were going at it, eh?
Yeah.
Yep.
And the rest of us, well, I was in extreme pain. I was in so much pain and I swelled out so much that when the, well, to begin with, all the Americans rushed for this telephone. Okay, so you couldn't get near a telephone. And I worked out that it was in the early hours of the morning back here. So I waited. And when I did ring through, my husband, he wasn't at that time. I had this accident under a previous name of Nisbet, Beverly Nisbet.
Right.
We were getting married, but I was doing this trip before. And he said that out of the blue, he suddenly woke up wide awake, and with that, the phone went.
Like something it tuned into him. And,
yeah. And that's when I burst into tears. Up until that stage, I'd been reasonably brave, but it was a very lonely experience on my own.
I can imagine. Did at any time during, you know, the return to Honolulu, did you have any sort of gut feel on your chances?
It looked as though we were going to land in the sea. We all sort of thought we were going to land in the sea. There were three Japanese girls sitting behind me and I was sort of holding their hand and I was holding the old bloke's hand beside me and he was saying, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
Wow.
And I just thought east is east and west is west and we're all in this together.
Yeah.
You know, I was crossing my mind that I'm breathing and would I suddenly be not breathing, you know. How would it feel like to be alive 1 second and dead the next?
Yeah. All those things sort of rush through your thinking.
Yes. But I was praying very hard too, don't worry.
I bet everyone was.
Yeah.
The prayer power coming out of that aircraft would have been humongous, to use Dave Cronin's word. So it happened at a time where there's no one around, the help wasn't instantaneous, and that people had to sort of like cope initially anyway on their own without outside assistance. Did David Cronin and his crew appear at any time?
No, we never saw them.
Yeah.
Never saw them at all. I don't know. I suppose they would have all been last off down the chutes. The thing is that we didn't know whether the plane would break in two or go on fire, you know, when it landed. You didn't know.
Yeah.
And it was the softest landing I've ever did because those wing brakes, they weren't working. The tires were all flat.
Yeah, from the braking, right? They would have been standing on the brakes.
And Dave didn't know whether he was going to be able to stop or whether he'd been out the other side of the airport.
Yeah.
But it did. It stopped. It sort of didn't. It just stopped.
They made him pretty tough, obviously, though it was terrible that cargo door opened itself. All right, so obviously there's a wait time and the airport activity starts to, imagine with more urgency, starts to ramp up and you've got what, paramedics?
It starts to ramp up. It would appear that most of the injuries were to do with, like, rope burn, you know, their bare skin going down the chutes.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, sort of chafed.
Friction burns, aren't
they?
Yes, yeah.
That's the word. And but anyway, they eventually arrived with a dried-out-looking bread roll and a bit of coffee. On a tea wagon, I tell you, it was terrible. There was absolutely nothing at that stage to help. And by this stage, I was so swollen with the impact, I could hardly walk. So when the medical team arrived, I reported into them. And they saw me first. Then I was the first one into the FBI to tell them what that they asked. Did I think it was a bomb or, you know? Because
they would have thought that probably first.
Yeah, they wouldn't let you out of the airport until you'd been interviewed by them. And, of course, when the doctor saw me so swollen and could hardly walk, he wanted me up to the hospital to get x-rays and things. So I went through the FBI and told them what I thought, which yeah. I don't know what I said it could have been a bomb. And so then I was escorted to what turned out to be a long, one of these long limousines that they have over there, you know, big stretch limousine.
Yep.
To take me up to the...
Well, in
but,
style.
But what did happen was, from just being an ordinary Kiwi coming home from a holiday, suddenly I was thrust with a ray. By this time, the media had arrived, but they weren't allowed in amongst us. And the minute I got through the gate, they began all the way. What's your name? What's your age? You know, and blah, blah, blah. That sort of followed me up to the hospital. They gave me a PR person, a lovely lady who stayed with me all day. And they did the x-rays, and fortunately I didn't have a broken hip, but I had very big bruising, the scar, which was still with me 6 months later. The outline of this bruise was still with me. And anyway, after they x-rayed, they let me have a bit of a doze. I think they sedated me. And then this PR lady came and said that all the media were anxious to interview me, would I be willing? And I'm thinking to myself, maybe if I talk about it, it might help me talk my feelings about it. So I ended up with a news media around a great big oval table, all firing questions at me.
A new experience for you.
Was it ever?
Yeah.
And then I mentioned to one of them that I had taken two pictures on my camera. Well, they took the camera.
Oh, they would have been even more interested in that.
And anyway, he got back to me and he said, oh, he said, those photos are great. It was only two, only those two. And he said, oh, we'll buy them from you. And I said, oh, no, you can have them.
Oh, dear.
No, they said, oh, no, we buy. He said, I'll give you $3,000 for them. And I said,
okay, yeah.
So I said, yes, okay. Anyway, when I did get home, my husband said to me, you'll never see that money. And I did. 6 months later, out of the blue, it arrived in an envelope. They gave me back the negatives and everything, but they later sold them to, I can't think of the name. It's a magazine, one of the magazines over there has got the copyright of them.
Okay, yeah.
I think, yeah. But they gave me back the negatives, so I developed them and had them enlarged and that, yeah.
Okay, at this point I want to ask you about Lee Campbell because he was a Wellingtonian. I think he was on a business trip.
Yeah, he was 24.
Yeah.
The strange thing is that as I sat talking to him, I said that I was catching a flight to Napier when we got into Auckland.
Yep.
And if I'd mentioned the word Hastings, which is where I live, it turned out he was engaged to a girl from Hastings who actually was in the class with my daughter, the one I was visiting.
Gosh, is it such a small world, Beverly?
Yeah. It is, but I never mentioned the word Hastings, so I only discovered that when I met his parents.
So you met him at Los Angeles, was it?
No, Honolulu.
Oh, sorry, Honolulu. Yeah, I'm getting a bit behind myself. Honolulu, and weren't you sitting next to him?
Yes, well, I was just sitting, you know, how they have seats for you to sit in the departure lounge. And I was just sitting on my own. I'd been there for quite a while when the plane came in and he came off it because he had travelled from LA to Hawaii on it. And he just happened to sit in the seat next to me. But he was a friendly guy, so we just got talking. And then, you know, for him to tell me what he'd bought in new shoes and a suit, and there were several other things, but they were the two things that, you know, and to find that his case had come home, And when they opened it, the things I'd told them were in that case.
What happened to Lee?
Well, it turns out that he actually had swapped seats with someone, but it wouldn't have made any difference because this one, the person he swapped with went out as well. Three rows of seats, I think, went out. Yeah, nine people.
And Lee was one of them. And you met him, you saw the items in his suitcase.
I never saw them. He only described them to you.
Yeah, he described them to you. Okay. Did the suitcase go out or did it stay in the plane?
No, no. Some luggage was lost. I had two bags. One of them was quite badly damaged, but some people's actual luggage went out because the hole was in the cargo part as well.
Hmm. And his parents, Lee Campbell's parents, who's from Wellington, as I mentioned before, were heavily involved in the aftermath and investigation to try and get to the truth of what happened, how that cargo door opened. That was another big story again on its own, right?
Yes, that's really, that's their story. But Kevin, of course, I had more to do with them when we went down staying with them. And as I said, when Dave Cronin came back to get the special award that New Zealand gave him, I was there. And that's when I met him, and I've got pictures of us together, and they took him touring around. I don't know, where are you talking from, Auckland or Wellington?
I'm talking from Wellington.
Well, do you know Mount Kaukau?
Yes, I do.
Okay. We went up, we climbed up to the top of Mount Kaukau, and Dave actually, he had a girlfriend with him at the time. And so I've got photos of that. But when he died, I'm jumping
that's okay.
A bit. I sent a card to his family, and I get this letter back from his daughter saying that she and her father had planned to come for a trip to New Zealand. They were busy planning it when he had this coronary and died suddenly.
Yeah.
And so she had decided that she would still come, and she was going to be bringing some of his ashes, and she would like me to suggest where they could be thrown. And I suddenly thought, Mount Kaukau. So
wow.
I got in touch with Kevin and Susan Campbell, and we met up with Kathy. She scattered some at Tiana. He must have been there and liked it because she went there. And then she came up, and the five of us, that's my late husband and myself and the Campbells and Kathy, we climbed up to Mount Kaukau, and you can see the South Island and Wellington and Hutt Valley, you know. And that's where she's distributed some of Dave's ashes. And a big gust of wind came and blew them into her face, and she said, thanks, Dad.
That is amazing to hear that. Probably hardly anyone knows that, which is another connection. You know, it's just a...
So, yeah, well, we got a stick. There was a bit of a rock sticking out of the ground, and we got a stick and we scratched his initials on it. So I'm never likely to ever walk up there again.
But, well, I could. So I might be on the lookout now.
Yes, yes, it's up at the top. It's not a big rock. I think I took a photo of it, but we just scratched DC on it, you know. And then she came and stayed a few days with me up in Hastings and went on her way.
In the documentary that I mentioned where I heard that quote from Dave Cronin, you know, the doco on 811. There was also in the part where the Campbells were appearing and they were talking about Lee, and I could be wrong here, maybe you can help me out. There were pictures from inside his bedroom.
Yes.
And he'd done a mural on the wall of him, I don't know, exiting or parachuting out.
A big void, a big space in the middle. It was almost as if he had realised what was going to happen to himself.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking, I was going through some of my stuff. I might have the magazine that was featured in.
Yeah. When I saw that, I thought, this story is
bizarre.
Yeah. Okay. So David Cronin himself, what sort of, and this is, we're kind of coming to the end now, what sort of, and I know the other crew are there as well, and they did everything incredibly as well, and they were part of the effort, but he led it. What was he like as a person?
Well, no, he was very nice. This it's in the Christian Courier. It's a publication that I don't know how I came by. I think I got it when I was over there. We stayed with him, and he took Eddie and me all around Lake Tahoe and showed us the yacht he owned. And well, yes, this woman, his wife, she was learning to be a gliding pilot, and she went and had an affair with the instructor and wrecked that marriage. Oh. So when we met him, he was single again.
Okay.
So he sort of had a bit of a hard life as far as women go.
What did he say about, because in the introduction here, when we started talking right at the very start, I mentioned, well, I read out the bit that you said, that David Cronin, a born-again Christian, knew what guided him safely back that night.
Yes.
What was that? What did he know?
Oh, he knew that God was guiding him, the divine was guiding them, and I knew that too when we landed safely. So he starts off, my goal was to be captain of my ship, master of my fate, and he explains what a wild life, you know, and he explains that the explosive decompression tore at the door of his reason for living, but by the time... For the first time, my ship was sinking and my fate hung in the balance. It took the wind of the sails life from my spirit and left me in a stunned and speechless vacuum. You'll have to read it. It's too good.
Yeah.
I can't read it.
Yeah. Okay. All these years later, Beverly, how does a memory like that sort of recede, or does it ever?
Well, it doesn't with me. And I felt when you were quoting, whatever it was now that you were quoting, that that's where you were coming from.
I was. Yeah. That sometimes it applies to everybody. The sum total of things can feel like they, like Cronin said, I mean, there are other things happening in his life and everything, but the sum total of effort put in all those years, regardless of everything else in your life, was available for that one moment, and that moment comes along, and somehow you're the person who's there.
And yes, and he says that he was calm too. He just knew he was instructed to keep calm, and he his co-pilot wanted to put the landing gear down, and something told him that it was too soon to put the landing gear down, and he said, no, not yet, we'll wait. And he did, and that was the right decision. If they'd put it down sooner, something would have happened.
Yeah. Wow. What a story. Gee.
Well, that's only bits and pieces of it, I'm telling you.
Yeah, we've only got so much time.
I know.
Yeah.
That's why you should drive up and see me.
I hear you. I hear you. Don't you worry. I hear you. It's been really interesting speaking with you. And even the fact that we connected, I mean, I'm nowhere near, you know, the other things involved in this. But again, there just seems to be these connections.
Well, it's funny. My son and daughter-in-law are both born-again Christians. He was brought up a Christian, but he had a few wild days, so his testimony is pretty mind-blowing too. This is my son. But his wife sent me a text with that little clip of you talking about Dave Cronin, and she just said, I think you might be interested in this. And I did, and it had comments at the bottom, so I made that comment.
Yeah.
I wasn't really expecting to hear any more at that stage.
Well, I certainly had no idea using that analogy at the time, which occurred to me only about 15 minutes before I got up to speak. It sort of kind of shot into my head. Anyway, these things happen, right? These things happen. Mm-hmm. They actually do.
They do.
All right. Well, incredible to talk to you. Thank you for sharing the story.
I'm just sad that you weren't able to sort of see, and I've got all this stuff sitting around me that I was going to show you. I've got a picture of Dave Cronin sitting in his little glider thing, and on the back of it he tells me he was doing acrobatics in it. Wow. So, you know.
Oh, well. No, I understand that, and that's just one of the unknowns with our technology and bandwidth and everything like that. But I will get to see them, Beverly. Don't you worry. I'll try and find
it. Yeah, well, if I had an address, I noticed that there is an address on some of the information. It says address P.O. Box something Ponsonby in Auckland.
That rings a bell.
So if I were to send something with your name on the outside, I'll see if I can take a copy.
Yeah, take a copy. Don't send the original stuff that you've got, please.
No.
I couldn't live with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on. Thanks for getting in touch. Great to be able to chat with you. It's an incredible story, and it does make you think about things, doesn't it? It really does.
It does. It does make you think. And as I said, I unintentionally was just an ordinary Kiwi coming home and found myself mixed up with the media. And that media, I came home and found photos of myself that I barely knew about in all the newspapers all around New Zealand. Yeah. I've got a pen friend from South Africa who has the same name as, well, was my name then, Beverly Nisbet. I'm still in touch with her. She read it in a paper in South Africa and said it was funny to see her name, knowing it wasn't her. I had another person from America write to me as well, thought she was related to me. So.
Far and wide.
I didn't intend to be in the public eye, but I have given quite a lot of talks, but I didn't do anything till I was about 15 years down the track. And I was asked to give a talk, and then, as happens, somebody in the audience belonged to something else and they needed a speaker, and suddenly you're the top speaker in the district for a few years.
Yeah, for a great story. Totally.
Yes, and I don't do it with how they do them nowadays with overhead projection. Yeah. I've just got a notice board that I pin all my bits and pieces onto.
Old stuff.
But anyway, think seriously while I'm still alive. You know, I'm getting a bit ancient now.
Oh, well, you're clear as, lucid as far
Well, I am at the moment. It took quite a few years for me to get up on a plane. And one thing that you do know is that when you're up there, there's not a darn thing you can do when things go wrong.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But it also, more people are killed on the roads than are killed up in the air.
Yeah.
And when I did get home, and I came home, and then I wouldn't get back on United Airlines, and I haven't been on United Airlines since, although they were very good. They were very, you know, good. But all sorts of little bits and pieces are happening of United Airlines, even recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Window pop, you know.
Yeah, wheels falling off, windows popping out.
You know, but anyway.
I don't think it's just them. I think it's other airlines have had problems as well. It's more the manufacturing standard.
Well, of course, the Campbells, you know, Boeing wouldn't take responsibility, and United Airlines, they had all that to negotiate when they went. And he worked out what had caused that to happen, because he was an engineer, and he showed us a little miniature of, he'd made a little miniature of that door.
Yep.
But they couldn't prove it until they lifted the door off the seabed, and it was about 2 miles down, and they did in 1992.
And that confirmed it.
And that confirmed that his theory had been right. It was an electrical malfunction of the doing up part of the
They did suspect it, because I remember reading somewhere ages ago that a new procedure was inserted into their checklists, and one of those items was to pull out the circuit breaker that controlled the electrical system to the cargo door. So if there was any fault once it was locked, nothing could ever happen. And they didn't do that for no reason.
Yes, and it wasn't only the people in business class, because the first class was up stories above, you know, upper deck. And a lot of them had burst eardrums and things from the decompression. So there we are.
There we are, Beverly. We're out of time.
Okay.
So good to hear that story from Beverly Thomas, who was a passenger on United Airlines Flight 811, the flight that Captain David Cronin commanded. And Beverly got in touch after seeing that little piece from me. I feel so small next to David Cronin. I do.
No, you're fine.
But incredible story. Our listeners, I would have imagined, were sitting there just hanging for the next piece of it all the way through. Thanks for coming on, and all the best, Beverly, to you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Lovely talking to you.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.